Hi, welcome to Outrageous, our bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, culture, politics, and everything in between. I am joined by my two very best friends, Trisha in LA.
Hello.
And Jason in DC. How you doing?
Happy to be here bi-weekly now. I like how you just slipped that in.
I know. Cool. Hey, everybody. This is happening bi-weekly now because we cannot get it together. I'm just going to be really honest. We can't get it together to do it weekly. So we're going to do it every other week, currently on a Monday. And, you know, if you don't like that, you can let us know, but we're not doing anything about it. Like, that's just the way
it's Well, it's really strange. Isn't it actually bi-monthly? Because bi-weekly suggests twice a week.
No, that's semi-weekly. Semi-weekly.
No, bi-weekly, if you look it up, actually is both things.
It's ambiguous.
It's very upsetting.
It's like a bad use of English.
You know what? It's like another... we have a lot of ambiguous words, like brother-in-law.
Why is that ambiguous?
Think about it. Who is your brother-in-law?
Husband, or it's your wife's brother.
Exactly.
Well, but that's clear.
It's either your... How is that clear? It's two different people.
It could be either one.
Husband or your wife's brother.
But I'm still related by marriage on some level. But this bi-weekly suggests twice a week. I'm like, twice a week? Bi-monthly.
Well, you could say bi-weekly is not weekly one way or the other. So it's just as clear as brother-in-law.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to do the intro over. Hi, welcome to our every other week podcast where we talk about a whole bunch of shit and then Trisha and Jason go off for 10 minutes about language. How about that? That's a good intro.
I like that.
Wow.
I think we have a new format. I'm ready. I like this. Let's talk about the Oxford comma.
You know what? Don't get me started about the Oxford comma because don't even get me started. I love the Oxford comma. Anyway,
I do too.
Trisha and I just got back from San Francisco.
You went without me.
Well, we invited you. We invited you.
I didn't get an invitation.
Wow.
This was reverse race discrimination.
From now on, we're recording all of our conversations because we said, hey, come to San Francisco. You're like, meh, I'm a father. I have responsibility. And we're like, we are single and have tons of disposable income. Bye. And we took off to San Francisco.
Which apparently San Francisco decided to test. How much disposable income do you really have?
The most expensive city I've ever been to outside of London. It might have been more expensive than London.
And dirty.
I was wondering if you were going to say that in public.
You just alienated our whole left coast listener base.
Just between the three of us. Just between the three of us.
I like
San Francisco is filthy. It's gross. I'm sorry.
It is. I like San Francisco, theoretically. But
as an idea, as a concept.
As a concept. You know what? Because for years, whenever I'm abroad and people ask me which U.S. city is closest to sort of a European city, I always said San Francisco. Because maybe 5 years ago, that was still San Francisco in my mind when I used to visit it more frequently. But having gone to San Francisco this weekend, I'm going to have to pull back from that. Because most European cities are not that dirty.
I'm surprised to hear this. I haven't been in San Fran in a while, but I hear that the gentrification has just skyrocketed, which, and this is maybe a problem on my part, I would have assumed meant less filthy, but sounds like no.
No. You know what gentrification means in San Francisco? Gentrification means that certain neighborhoods are maybe great, but the downtown has been fully abandoned on some level.
Oh, gotcha.
To the homeless people and tourists. And it's a weird thing because you're basically advertising your city as this wonderful place for tourists, and then every two blocks, not even.
Two blocks.
I think we were clocking homeless people as we walked. I think I said, let's just figure out how many homeless people we're going to pass in this block. I think we were up to 16.
Yeah, by between one corner and the next. And I'll tell you, Trisha left in the morning and I was there until the evening. Like, Trisha, I was just walking around in the day, like, trying to get some breakfast and stuff. And maybe I was just in that particular part of the mission. But, like, I was the only non-homeless person on the street at one point. I remember looking back and forth. I think I was like maybe near like a day hotel or something, but I was like, this can't, like, this is crazy. But then again, it wasn't so different from any other part that we really been that we were really in. The only part of town I didn't see homeless people was Japantown. That's it.
And you know, it's not to say that I want to have the reaction that that crazy, what was it, stockbroker, or no, it was probably a tech guy, where he wanted all the homeless people to be removed in some horrendous way or something. But it was more just a real sensitivity to the fact that we are failing that population.
Yes,
clearly.
And that's, like, I'm so curious. I'm going to look it up. Like, I'm very curious about the services they have for the homeless and the mentally ill in San Francisco, and if they're worse than what we have here or in other cities. Because I found, like, I found the homelessness to be so
present.
So present in a way that it's not in New York. And I'm not saying the shelter system is great here either. But
or even in LA. But maybe it's because people are in cars more in it. I don't know. But I'm not in a car in LA.
Yeah. But so Jason, you missed out on that. Also, you missed out on spending all your money. I went to go to get a pizza. Like a personal like a personal pizza, one of those small 7-inch, 8-inch pizzas.
Yeah.
And it was this place called Extreme Pizza. And I went in there, and I got a personal pan pizza and a water. And he was like, $15, please.
Wow.
And I said, how? First of all, how? And I mean by ingredient. I want you to break it down and tell me how this costs $15. And not for nothing, it wasn't even very good. So San Francisco, 3.5 stars.
Three and a half.
The way you talked about it, it sounded like it was a half a star.
True. No, we giving it 2 stars.
Fun. So let's cut the difference.
That had nothing to do with San Francisco.
Yeah, you guys could have come to D.C.
Yeah.
All right, Jason. Everyone needs to go to D.C. God damn it.
I'm here.
I will say, just to wrap this up, though, like you, Tricia, whenever anyone asks me what's the prettiest American city, my answer has always been San Francisco. Now I'm going to have to think about it.
I'm taking a serious hard look at that.
I have to review the American cities I've been to. Okay. Let's jump into what we're here to do, and that is to talk about a lot of crazy shit. So I want to start with Trisha's, because let's just get it out of the way, Trish. Please. Get the fuck out of the way.
I feel like you can say one sentence, Trisha, and we can just move on.
Just say one word. Just shout it out. Just say his name.
I don't want to
say his name.
Don't ruin my Sunday.
I'm sorry. Okay, so I have to, obviously, when I was contemplating my topic for the week, I couldn't move beyond this topic. It's just the most pressing thing on my mind. Mm. And so my topic is, how did we end up with Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party? And what lessons do we need to seriously learn so that we don't end up with Donald Trump as our president? I just want us to unpack that a little bit, because when he first started running, newscasters were laughing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He has had the last laugh. Okay, so yes. What went wrong? What went wrong? Please inform me.
I hardly know where to begin.
Begin somewhere.
I just want to say, The Onion posted an article 4 years, 4 or 8 years ago when Obama was elected, The Onion obviously being satire, and it was like, the cover story was, shrieking white-hot ball of rage nominated for Republican Party. And the idea was that the collective racism and bigotry, and just that that was what they were going to elect as a nominee. 4 years ago, that seemed like satire. That's literally what motherfucking happened. That's literally what happened. And it's shocking. I mean, we can come at this from a lot of different angles. It's either of you can just throw a bone out there, we can just tackle it. But I want to say that I don't think he's going to be president. I think everyone, up to and including Donald Trump, is as shocked as we are.
Okay, so then how did we get here? What did we fail to take seriously?
I think the Republican Party, we've had this Hell No Caucus or Freedom Caucus. I mean, the Republican Party has stopped governing. And it's not that they all wanted to stop governing, but just in effect, because of the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus and the fraction between, you know, evangelicals and fiscal conservatives, they failed as a party. That means that their constituents feel like they've gotten nothing from them after voting for them. And so Donald Trump, who I think has been a master marketer his whole career, that is his talent and his skill set more than anything else, and he applied those skills to, and he marketed his way to the nomination, and it's masterful. So to me, the lesson is the Republican Party, and not that this is easy to do, but they need to build their party back, that they actually have an agenda, and they actually pursue it and deliver something for their constituents, because they've delivered nothing for 8 years.
I think you really hit the nail on the head there, is that the Republican Party, well, let's just focus on the Republican Party. The Republican Party has moved so far away from practicality. They're a complete rhetorical party.
That's right.
So now that they've, and especially in the past 8 years since Obama's been in office, since everything they have been doing and saying is about rhetoric and drama, it is perfect. As a matter of fact, it is ordained that someone like Donald Trump
could
absolutely seize that. Trisha, your question of what lessons can we learn is really sticking with me, because I think the lesson really has to be the Republican Party has to learn. The whole rise of the Tea Party and this sort of nihilistic, anarchist kind of idea that we don't need a government, they really went too far. Because at the end of the day, those people did not get elected to office to not govern. They want to govern. They just want to govern in a really particular way. However, the way that they actually want to get things done, they weren't really clear about it. Maybe they weren't clear about it, but I think everyone is certain now the way what Trump is doing or what he wants to do or how he's doing it is not correct. So the lesson really for the American people, yes, but we can get to that. But I think the Republicans are the ones who really have to be taken to school here.
Agreed.
Well, you know, what struck me in terms of how we have been challenged to think about Donald Trump, and I think the only person who's been challenging us to think seriously about Donald Trump has been Barack Obama, our president, and he's been pushing on, quote-unquote, what, the fourth arm of government, which is the media, to begin to take itself seriously and to challenge Donald Trump when he makes claims, because he's been getting a pass. I just saw something quickly across my timeline this morning that he made this claim that Americans pay the highest taxes in the world. That's clearly false.
Untrue. Yeah, clearly untrue.
That's clearly wildly inaccurate. Wildly.
Yeah, it's wildly inaccurate, and the person he said it to simply said, uh-huh.
I don't totally agree.
With what part?
With that the media has given him a pass. I mean, I've heard a ton of analysis since the day that he started running where news shows did fact check and dispute. This is where it gets back to
what news shows? What news shows, though? Because are they news shows that you watch?
Well, no.
Are they the ones that you watch, or are they the ones that the majority of Americans
watch? All right, it's NPR, okay? It's NPR.
Okay, NPR. We can't use NPR.
All right, I'll shut up.
It's not mass media.
No, don't shut up. You're making a point, but maybe mainstream
media. Here's my point. I don't think there's been a complete absence of fact-checking. I'm hesitant to completely blame it on the media. Now, I think the media certainly has a role, but, and we talked about this on a prior podcast, like, there's a constant interaction between what the general population wants to consume and what the media delivers. And the media could do a better job of delivering quality, but we as a consumer base often don't want quality. I mean, we like to watch drama and outrageous claims. We like that. And so I feel like it's harder and harder, in my opinion, to blame the media, given that we have the internet now and people's reactions to things online in terms of what we click on, what we spend time on. You know, the media has all these metrics now. What do people actually want to see, hear? And the reality is people want to hear crazy talk about building walls and banning Muslims. And I think it's a give and take, and I don't have a solution. I'm just hesitant to totally blame the media. I think it's a problem on both sides.
You just indicted the media. If we have all these metrics and people in here about crazy walls and banning Muslims, and the fact that the media continues to deliver that sort of stuff because they know it gets eyeballs, that's an indictment of the media. That's not news reporting.
Well, I don't mean to defend or justify, but the media is a very tough business right now.
And... Oh, come on. What's going on? What's happening? You are defending them. It's a tough business. What does that mean?
All right,
they have a job to do.
They have a job to do, but they won't have jobs to do if they produce things that no one consumes. That's the irony. That's the challenge.
This is a snake eating its own tail. I mean, if they produced stuff, like, we would have to consume it because it's the stuff that's being produced. But they're giving in to the least common denominator.
They're in a competitive marketplace. So if one outlet is doing like, look, I consume NPR. Mm-hmm. People aren't listening to NPR because maybe they're not doing enough of the bullshit. So it's hard. Like I guess if I take a step back, I say, and I don't have the specific solution. There's a deep structural problem with how we produce and receive news in this country. The fact that it is in such an economic marketplace, that's what brings it to the lowest common denominator. So I don't mean to say they're not culpable. I mean to say we're all culpable.
Well, I mean, for me, though, I understand that the media occupies a landscape where they have to think about the economy, they have to think about getting eyes. But what I was also mostly shocked by were sort of, quote unquote, the legitimate news spaces. So, for example, immediately after, say, a debate, that's a space where you still have the American eyes, and you have a responsibility to challenge what people said in the debate. Many of his statements were left completely unchallenged, even in the debate structure. You know, because in some ways, I mean, even his opponents let him get away with saying wild things within the Republican Party.
That's true.
And I mean, I guess also because the Republicans really spent 7 years tossing all sorts of wacky ideas out there, mm-hmm. I guess on some level they were incapable of actually pulling back when it really mattered.
Yeah.
Well, they were
so
already
this is sort of the right? So they this were, was the natural extension. But it was so outrageous. I mean, I was looking at it, I'm like, okay, this is not Fox News. A lot of these things weren't happening on Fox News, right? So it's like you were having a public debate on ABC, and you, quote unquote, were supposed to have legitimate news people there talking about the talking points after. And at no point in time did they just go, all of these things that were said in the statement, false. It was done later. It was done midday. Remember, the Republican debates captured such a wide array of people because of its entertainment value that immediately thereafter, when they were still tuned in, that was when reporters were supposed to take their job seriously and say, you know what, 50% of the things Donald Trump said, we were fact-checking them all along because he never said anything new. So it's not as if you couldn't continue to bang that bell, you know, and say, well, as we've said in the past, these 10 things are untrue. They just sort of let him lay things out there unchallenged.
Circling back to Donald Trump and tying in what you guys are saying, Trisha, you talked about the lesson to be learned. This is a very hard lesson that we're going to learn, and it's going to have to be a cultural shift at some point. Our media exists in an economic environment and an increasingly entertainment environment.
That's right.
Sure.
And so now it's everything that you're saying. Like, fact-checking Donald Trump isn't as fun as letting him talk. Because when you let him talk, people listen. And when people listen, they watch your TV shows and your commercials. They download your podcast. Hello, we're talking about Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera. To the point where this is the apex. This is where those two things intersect. It's everything that was wrong with this marriage back in the day when it first happened, when news and entertainment held hands for the first time. This was always going to be the baby they were going to have, Donald Trump as president of the United States. Because who else could run a country where all of our media is filtered through comedians and bombastic entertainers like Trump? Who else could we possibly elect? A real politician can barely get in there.
I want to then take this back to the Republican Party to say I think a lot of Republicans for a long time have seen it as in their party's interest to have an institution like Fox News to be able to say crazy shit and not have it fact check. And as I think both of you have kind of alluded to, Donald Trump has taken that to the extreme, and maybe, hopefully, something the Republican Party will learn is that if you do the work to operate in a world without facts, it's going to come back to bite you. You can lose control of the narrative as quickly as you were able to create a narrative, and maybe they'll be more invested in facts and truth and real news.
You know what's interesting that you—it's interesting you bring that point up, Jason, because I've seen something come across my news feed this week that said that the lesson Bernie Sanders, sorry, Christopher.
Oh my God!
I thought that was the condition.
I know.
I said to Trisha if she wanted to talk about this, she could not bring up Bernie Sanders.
I'm sorry. Stop it.
Make your point quickly.
So according to Bernie Sanders, his lesson, because again, we have to understand how these two people are related, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. However, his lesson was that the left needs their own Fox News.
Isn't it called MSNBC?
And I thought to myself,
yeah, we have it. What are you talking about?
No. But no, because MSNBC, I think, attempts to just spin things maybe a certain way, but it still has to truck in quote-unquote facts. I was wondering what he actually meant.
Yeah,
I was like, okay, so let's define Fox News. If Fox News is a place where we are anti-science, anti-facts.
Anti-women, actual people of color.
And does that mean that that's exactly what he wants us to do, but from a left point of view? I don't understand what that means.
I guess he wants a news station where they say things like, studies show abortions are great for you. It tightens your skin and makes you look younger. I don't know. Like, what is it about?
I didn't understand what that meant.
I don't know.
Well, I didn't see what kind of lies
would you tell to support leftists. The best things you can say to support a leftist ideology is the truth, right?
No, but I think what he wants is something like a Democracy Now on like a major platform. I'm assuming that's what he means. I mean, when you say we should have our own Fox News, I think essentially he basically says, okay, we just want a political news station. So like a left political news station explicitly. Just the way that Fox was an explicitly sort of right-wing news station. So maybe that's the lesson he means, not something that's anti-intellectual,
you know what?
But one that's clearly platform-based. Maybe that's what he's saying.
Like most of the things that Bernie Sanders says, that sounds like a fantasy. Like, I just don't know.
No, it doesn't sound like a fantasy.
I can't begin to get my mind around it. Like, I think the opposite of what Fox News does is real news, right? Which a lot of liberal podcasters and talking heads try to get to. They actually use facts, real information, to debunk the right and show the world as it really is. I don't understand what it would be like.
No,
I disagree because, I mean, what I think, Chris, you framed earlier about Trump, and I've heard, like, David Brooks, who's a conservative Republican, but he has said this about the Republican Party. I heard him say this some months ago, that it's become a party of self-expression. People in the Republican Party are running to express themselves, not to govern. When I hear what you're saying, and I hadn't heard it before, but to me, the opposite of Fox News or the left-wing Fox News is not facts. It's left-wing rhetoric, which is exactly Sanders, right? It's free college for everyone. It's left-wing, you know, quasi-socialist ideas being said without any facts or strategy to achieve it, just as on Fox News, it's right wing ideology spouted.
Well, where does that leave us though?
I don't think it's a good idea, but
It leaves you in a space where, listen, what he's essentially suggesting is that we cop to the environment that we live in. We cop to the fact that the American public wants to live and inhabit a rhetorical space. But the problem is that the right isn't being balanced out in some ways with its own rhetorical space on the left. So that we basically say, listen, we've lost the battle. rhetoric is where we live, so therefore we need a leftist rhetoric space. And I guess it's true. We actually don't have one.
But I disagree. I think it's bad for the country.
I understand this point.
Exactly. It may be bad for the country, but you need a balance of something else that's bad for the country. So if you want to have fantasies of walls against Mexicans, you should have the fantasy of Mexicans walking through the United States of North America.
Like the,
I understand what Sanders is saying, right? Because I don't think it's so much about balance as much as it is an understanding that rhetoric is what's moving a significant portion of the country.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's what you said, like free college for everyone, you know, all the things that I've been tearing Bernie Sanders down for is exactly the kind of things that got an entire movement around him. And I think that's what he's talking about. Like, we need to wage an ideological war against the right and maybe not present facts, even though facts might be on our side as far as like governance is concerned. That's not what people are responding to. However, it is bad for the country, because when you have someone screaming into the wind and you're trying to pull them back from the void, what you probably shouldn't do is shout across the void at them. Now everyone's shouting into the void. Like, it just, I don't think that's going to be productive. And I fear for where the country would actually end up. Because look at this. Years of the right wing chomping at the bit and being insane has led us to Donald Trump. I don't know if everyone was doing that where we'd end up. We really would end up with Donald Trump versus Alec Baldwin. And who are you going to vote for? That would be a nightmare.
Maybe some people really like the fantasy of Alec Baldwin. I don't know.
Although, you know what, where you might end up? And I'm not endorsing this, but where you might end up is Hillary versus Jeb Bush or Hillary versus Kasich. Like, you might end up with more of a possibility of a moderate Republican running, because, you know, we have a moderate Democrat who's going to run because the framing, I mean, who's going to win because the right looks so far out there. Maybe if you had a left that looked far out there, maybe that opens up space for more moderate Republicans to run.
Okay.
Hope for the best.
Let's leave that there on a message of hope. Now we'll move on to a word from our first sponsor. I'm kidding. We don't have any sponsors. Wouldn't that be cool, though?
Not yet. We're ready to sell out to the first bidder. So if you're listening and you'd like to advertise, we will take you.
Our first sponsor is this really great crab rangoon I had last night. Everyone go out and have crab rangoon. Paid for by the Council for Crab Rangoon. Okay. I'm going to jump into my topic. I saw Captain America Civil War recently, and it was incredible. Everyone should go out and see it. And as you guys know, I'm a huge comic book fan, and I watch all the comic book shows. I've been reading comic books for a very long time. So what I was interested in when I was watching Captain America, none of which I will spoil if you're afraid of that, if you're listening, I will not spoil the movie. Because my topic isn't about the movie per se. It's about our ideas of heroes. I watch a lot of hero TV shows, Flash and Arrow, Daredevil, which just was on Netflix, the second season, which is really cool. Everyone should check it out. So in a lot of our hero stories, we shy away from killing. A lot of our current hero stories, we shy away from killing as an option. Heroes are selfless, but like almost impossibly humane in the story, in the plots that are created. Meanwhile, in real life, I remember the celebration around SEAL Team 6 killing Osama bin Laden, and a lot of the rhetoric coming out of that, and people were very excited about that. It seems to me that in real life, we are less concerned about the loss of life in like the path to righteousness and vengeance. Our past like has been littered with violence, vengeance, straight up torture, and our stories used to follow suit. There were tales about the Wild West, about killing bad guys, definitely the whole violence of this country as far as cowboys and Indians. If you go even further back, every biblical tale that does not directly involve Jesus has to do with bloodshed, death, and murder. So while our history hasn't changed, I feel like the stories we tell about heroics have changed to the point where the heroes that we tell stories about today, I'm not certain they reflect the culture we actually live in. And it just got me thinking when I was watching Captain America: Civil War, which is this grand story involving like a dozen heroes all fighting for a cause. in a way that seemed improbable to me, and a lot of the concerns that they had about life and damage and property seemed, it just seemed out of step to where we are. So I guess my question that I'm asking is, when we think of a hero, what does that mean today? And do you guys think it's shifted? And what are the morality tales today? And are the morality tales that we're telling today relevant?
I don't think we believe in heroes anymore. We're in such an anti-authoritarian moment. Not that a hero is necessarily an authority, but I feel like we have lost confidence in people's ability to be heroes, with some exceptions. I mean, I can think of exceptions here or there where someone saves people on a flight, you know, or saves someone. It's interesting what you're saying. I think a lot of the stories we like are stories of vengeance. I don't know that in real life we believe in the possibility of heroes anymore. I'm not sure that we do. That's my initial reaction to your question.
So I'm thinking about it because, you know, my hero, at least my sort of intellectual hero for quite some time, was Joseph Campbell, and he studied heroic tales, right? And I think one of the things that he talked about was sort of the failure of modern stories to provide what modernity needed. So he was saying like the clash of religions and sort of this pitting kind of religion against science was sort of tragic, because what that really suggested was that our stories hadn't sort of kept up with what was needed for a modern audience. And so what I actually think has happened is that we fail to understand how important narratives were to people. That there was a kind of cohesive, there was a value to narratives that rendered possibilities for people. Because that's really the power, right? That's supposed to be the power of the stories, that I'm telling you this story, and the story is going to endure because I'm imparting something valuable to you. And so the question for me now is that, are we so splintered, really, as a people, that we haven't been able to find unifying stories that point to values that we can all subscribe to?
Well, and, to flash back to the political side of this.
Yeah.
You know, heroes, the concept of heroes and heroics, we tell these tales because they're supposed to be educational, socializing.
Yep.
And we throw the term hero around a lot. Yes. Somehow, sports figures and firefighters are both heroes. I don't know what that means. But when you talk about our tales not keeping up with modernity, when you talk about, when I introduce the idea that our tales are no longer relevant, you look at the two men that we talked about already, Trump and Sanders, and how some believe that they are heralding some new age, right? They are coming, they're Prometheus, bringing us fire, dispelling the dark ages in a particular way, and their messages could not be more different. And the idea that, I know I throw this stat around a lot, I know it's not 50% of the country believes one and 50% of the country believes another, but we're talking about millions of people who go one way and millions of people who go another. Yeah. And that the conflict in that, the conflict that it seems to me, we don't really have an idea about what heroics mean anymore. I just want to tell you a little bit about, if you watch Daredevil, the Netflix show, the whole conflict was between the protagonist and the antagonist, both vigilantes. One protagonist was very clear that while he dressed up as a devil and went into the streets of New York and beat the shit out of drug dealers and rapists and the rest of them, he didn't kill them. And in some way, that made him better than the vigilante who had a lot of guns, and he was like, if I don't stop these people, they're just going to do it again, and he would just shoot motherfuckers through the head. The way the plot was written, we were supposed to root for one and not the other. And I thought that was really out of step with where we are right now, because I feel like where we are as a society, we'd be rooting for the antagonist, because there's something that makes a lot of sense about that. You know, I brought up SEAL Team 6 before. There's something that makes a lot of sense about, like, well, if we don't actually put these people down, they're just going to return and do worse and worse stuff. I don't know.
Well, Well, first of all, death in a heroic tale or a mythical tale had a place. And so maybe part of what's happened is that we've, as a culture, we have failed to understand the value of death. And we don't really explore death. And we don't really talk about what that means. And so we sort of, I think that's been sort of the failure of a lot of modern narratives, is to explore what it means to kill people. Now, the reason why I say this is because even though lots of our stories involve a lot of killing, we don't actually talk about it at all. And so I'll tell you, there was a TV show called The Killing.
That's perfect for what you're talking about.
But what was interesting, I remember when this TV show was introduced, I think it was about 5 years ago, and it was apparently a popular hit in Iceland or someplace.
Oh, some icy country. I don't think it was Iceland, I think it was like Norway or something.
Someplace like that. But the reason why the show was popular, or what was supposed to be compelling about the show, was that one girl had died in a town. And the show painstakingly explores how her death impacted everyone in the town. And I remember when it was coming here, and I thought to myself, and I read that premise and said, that's really silly. That's not going to work here. Because we don't unpack death like that. You know? And I remember watching it, and I thought it was sort of the weirdest thing to watch, given the way that we had comfortably told stories about people just dropping dead or being murdered left and right in other spaces. And it almost seemed, I hate to say it, I was like, damn, family, get the hell over it. That was my impulse when I watched it. And then as I was sort of taken through the entire season, I realized why I had problems with it, because I'd never seen anything like that before. I'd never seen someone say that a death ricochets out. I'd never seen that done on TV. You're supposed to cry the episode the death happens, and the next week you're supposed to go back to business as usual. The difference in that show was the family could not go back. The mom was in bed. You know, the other kids were inconsolable. We just didn't really unpack grief or any of that. And I just thought that was really fascinating. And I was like, you know what? We've never really confronted what it means to deal with loss culturally. And I think when you think about that in terms of the behavior of a hero, I think that's a huge challenge, right? Because that was, I mean, I understand why you were inspired by this topic, because the notion of death is a big thing in Captain America, the Civil War movie.
Right, don't say too much.
I'm not going to say. That's all I'm going to say. But it does make you question the idea of all the rampant killings that happen in every single movie. Like, look at Superman.
Must we?
No, but let's think about that, because that was something that came out at the end of that movie. People, at one point in time, someone actually did ask us, wait a minute, what is this guy doing? He's saving us, yet he's destroying entire streets where necessarily people are being killed willy-nilly.
So just if you haven't seen the last Superman movie, that's what Trish is talking about, is that Superman, in trying to protect Metropolis, ends up destroying most of it.
Exactly! And
at the end of the movie, people are like, hero?
It really pushed back on that. And I think that's one of the I think that has been a failing of our modern stories, is that we have not been exploring the cost of things.
I agree. I think there are two things here which are probably related. I think what you're bringing up, Tricia, is really important. And as a society, I mean, we have removed death from our consciousness. People die in hospitals and hospices. The family typically has no contact with the body after death, except maybe at a viewing where the body has been significantly embellished. We bury people and then we move on. And you know, you look at ancient civilizations with things like the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I mean, we don't want to talk about the dead. We don't want to talk about death. And we don't even want to talk about aging. I mean, you just look at where our society is going. Like, we don't even age anymore.
I know I don't.
So I think, so there's that. And then I think the other piece when it comes to heroism, and I didn't see the Superman movie, but I don't mind you spoiling it because I don't want to see it. But
it was very bad.
You said that. So, but you know, I think we still have this fantasy that there's a finite number of, quote, bad guys, unquote, right? There's a finite number of ISIS, and there's a finite number of super predators or whatever. And if we can just go out and hunt them down and kill them all or lock them all up, then everybody will be safe. And, you know, I think we've learned the hard way, those of us who pay attention, that it's just not the case. Like, there's not a finite number, and these things are dynamic. So when you do destroy a street, not only is there collateral damage / civilian casualties, but then people who were not, you know, radicalized or wanting to kill people now do want to kill people. And those are things I think we just haven't figured out. I do think, you know, if you look at the ancient stories, like you said, Chris, I mean, God swoops down and destroys a whole civilization,
holy shit. They're
gone.
Are you kidding me? Like, in Exodus, the Jews are just murdering everyone because God said so, and then it's celebrated. Like, these are tales of achievement. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Oh, we set out to do something, and we succeeded, and we killed 5,000 people.
Yeah, isn't there a story? I wish I remembered. I can't remember which one. There's a story where, like, they didn't kill all the livestock, and God got really pissed. Like, I told you to kill everything.
Get back in there!
Yeah, I told you to kill everything. How dare you disobey me? And, you know, in reality and practice, that's just not how things work. You can't just destroy a whole civilization and everybody lives better afterwards.
Okay, I think this is my question, right? In consuming all the superhero movies and stories that I take, but also just shows and movies about everyday heroic people, like I was mentioning to Trisha the other day, SVU, you know, when you watch Special Victims Unit, Law and Order, they're actually very concerned about life, you know, and even the criminals they pursue on that show are like the worst of the worst. They're constantly trying to apprehend them, which I think is really interesting because what I understand about the NYPD is quite the opposite. But what makes sense as a hero in 2016? Or is it just a fractured idea? Is heroics mean different things to different people? Because again, as I'm talking, I'm thinking about our current political landscape and our ideas about what is heroic or necessary or move us forward and help people is so different along so many lines. I think we no longer have a narrative culturally that works. Like, even nationally, we don't have a national narrative for heroics or progress in this way.
Can you think of one person that we have relative consensus that is or was a hero in this country?
I mean, I would say Martin Luther King. That's the first thing that comes to my head.
But I don't think we have consensus about that.
No, I think we do. I think we do, but I think the value of his heroism we don't have consensus about.
Oh, that's a good distinction, Trish.
I think what's interesting about the idea of Martin Luther King, though, as a heroic, which we could probably rally a good chunk of people around, is the redemptive nature of his death, right? Because essentially, this culture requires that someone. This is the funny thing: if Martin Luther King is heroic, then the culture requires heroes to be killed and sacrificed. And I think that's part of the challenge of the stories that we've been willing to tell now. The heroes can't be sacrificed in our stories. We're not willing to make that happen in our stories anymore. I don't know if it's because our stories are sort of placed within like the sort of political economic landscape where we just don't want to see that. But that's what I've noticed about the failings of our heroic stories, is that our heroes are not complicated. We make them really, really, really clean as best as we possibly can.
We try to, which is funny because life isn't clean. Our lives are no longer clean. Like, modern life is very, very messy, and we have problems and crimes that aren't as simple as good guys versus bad guys.
That's right.
And yet our stories remain in that vein. And I would expect an evolution.
But see, you
can't.
Don't know
how to tackle these ideas.
No, because what our stories required for a long time were good, were clearly good and clearly bad people. And part of, I think, what is compelling about Bernie Sanders, and I'll tell you this, let me reconnect it to your political, to the question of like, why do we have a political landscape the way we have it, Christopher? Think about Bernie Sanders and think about Hillary Clinton and think about Donald Trump. Think about the two people who have clearly created villains for you.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie and Trump, that's the thing they have in common, is they operate in a landscape where there are clear villains, which is very comforting to people.
That's right.
And one of the reasons that, one of the things that's really interesting is the notion of Hillary Clinton as complicated, messy, and really someone that you can't put comfortably any place. That is modernity. And think about how people want to deal. Think about how people deal with her.
That's a really great point, Tricia.
Yeah, I agree.
That's really good. So it's interesting that our concept of heroism is failing, but our concept of villainy
rises.
Is running apace.
Yes,
we understand villains clearly.
Yes, because then we can attack them.
That's right.
But we don't know what to do with someone who has to make complicated choices and sometimes fall afoul of it. Because we don't allow our heroes to do that.
So what you're saying is that in our modern tales, complication is the villain. Right?
Yes.
I think that's right. And I think it gets to what you were saying, Chris. When you were saying modern life is messy,
yeah,
that's all the more reason why people do want clear visions. We don't want messy stories because life is so messy.
Yeah.
If I'm going to walk into a dark movie theater and spend 2 hours watching a film, I want to know who the hell I'm rooting against, and I want to feel passionate about it.
What, and it's really funny because to bring it back to the movie, which we refuse to spoil, a lot of the movie, like Tricia said, death is very central to it, but also the root of the movie is a very complicated choice that the characters have to make, and it has to deal with the world as it is. But by the end of the movie, we sort of slot that off, and it becomes fairly simple for the audience and for the characters. Still a great movie, but to your point, Tricia, I see that now complication is the villain. In the beginning of that movie, it was like, oh, it's so much to consider, it's so much to consider. But by the time I got to the end, it was a really personal idea that had risen to the top. It was very simple.
Yes.
And I think that's the point. Oh, that's kind of – that does not make me feel good, though.
Well, it should.
I don't know if I was – I wasn't seeking to feel good at the end of this conversation.
But we're going to have to take this one again because Chris needs to feel good.
We ended someplace which I – because life is complicated, and narratives are important. And if our narratives are constantly about, you know, powerful people making very simple choices, it's becoming more and more fantastical. It's losing its power, even as a fable. We can't use those things anymore.
That's it. Because the point of a story, remember, and I think this is what's really interesting, is that narratives and myths were... they were also supposed to challenge us. They were not supposed to necessarily soothe us. So when you if you think about the sort of classic stories, the hero suffers a lot.
Well, martyrdom was a big deal back in the day.
But there was something redemptive in the suffering.
Right.
But now that's the whole story. But we don't want our heroes to suffer. Our heroes nowadays, we want them to have a little bit of hiccup. But then I want them to turn out okay. But I remember a sort of well-put-together story takes you through the ringer, and at the end of the story, it's supposed to leave you with an impression, right? It's supposed to leave you with something. I feel as if in our modern storytelling, nobody wants to leave you with any sense of, like, discord inside.
I think it's totally true. We want it wrapped in a bow. It is over, and we don't want
to think about it anymore.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, no more spoilers for American whatever. However, I do believe that is a central problem in that entire movie that the writers don't know what to do with.
Well, because they at the end of the movie.
Yeah, they raise a really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting question in the beginning that they themselves can't afford to tackle, so they simply abandon tackling it.
They're you'll understand this better, and they deliver you very personal stories, and you're like, oh, these choices are clean, and they really are.
There you go.
Interesting.
But you know, so it's like it complicates the world in the beginning and then immediately moves towards simplification.
That's not good for us. Sorry.
But that's not what narratives are supposed to do.
Yeah.
Narratives are supposed to complicate the world and then leave the world still complicated.
But the narrative is supposed to guide you through the complication, right? The world is complicated, and this is the beacon you should follow. Not the world is complicated, unless it's not, and you make it really, really simple. You make the hurdles really, really simple. Like, that's not what that's about. All right.
I mean, which is why I think this is the tension of our age, right? So you could look at, you can sort of look at Obama's presidency, let's come back to the political, as really that story, right? Is that he offered you a sort of beacon in the beginning, the hope change beacon.
Mm-hmm.
In his presidency, complexity arises.
So much complexity arises.
Yeah.
Instead of confronting that complexity, we now see this moment as a retreat. This is
You see it though? Like Obama,
yes.
Obama's narrative was so complex, right? He's like, I'm here to do these things, and on every single thing that he did, like, you know, this is a man
who's too complicated
while getting the Nobel Peace Prize, you know. Made all these promises to LGBT rights. He didn't do it immediately upon getting to office. It took him 6 years, and people were like frothing about the bit.
Look, Guantanamo Bay.
He was so complicated that our answer, our heroes, are Trump and Sanders, who are saying the most simple thing.
Right. It's so simple.
And then Hillary is the villain because she's looking at both of them. How are you going to accomplish that?
Right.
Shut up, Hillary.
It's complicated. It's going to be incremental. And it's no one has time for that. It's too boring. That's what she's too boring.
It's too boring. That's what I'm saying. But if you think about, just think about the old tale, right? Obama, if you think about Obama, just separate from his policies, whatever, his story was supposed to be the American story, right? Work hard, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de, come from working class families, which, by the way, I spoke to somebody today who wanted to convince me that Obama was like a wealthy, moneyed person.
That's fine. People, you know what? You look at people like that and be like, okay, can I have my coffee?
Okay.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Yeah, whatever. He's not really down. He's not really street. Sure. And I was like, okay, whatever.
Just bring up my groceries. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, whatever. I can't deal with that. No, it's just, I can't. So,
classism arises on the
podcast. I mean, but it was weird. All right. It was weird. You know what I mean? It was weird. Yes, he's now very, very wealthy, but you can't discount where he started. But anyway, you can for some people. So this notion, though, that you – but because remember, if you think about it, Obama's journey was supposed to be heroic. But people have rejected the heroic nature of his journey, thereby leaving them with nothing, right? Because it was like, go to college, get a degree, learn how to be sort of literate and engaged and smart and da-da-da. All of the things that he is, really, regardless of whether you agree with him or not. But you've just spent 7+ years telling us that there's no value to that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no value to being thoughtful. There's no value to being... thinking long term.
Thinking is simply too complicated. I have to say, I'm really glad I brought this up with you two, because you guys really, thank you for giving me, I really have a framework to think about this now. It's a disturbing framework. I don't like it, but I've always been very interested in hero tales and fairy tales, because, as you know, I work a lot with children, and these tales have a lot of power, a lot of socializing, instructive power, and I am worried if our current tales are about the world's complicated, but just don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it. Well, how do I get through it? Well, you know, simplicity is
complicated.
Yeah, that's not a good tale. But anyway, let's wrap this up, and let's hear from our second sponsor, which is, I don't know, this really great pen. I have. It writes really well. It never stutters.
Bring in the sponsor segment. Well, this is new. What happened?
Nothing. It's just that I feel like it's a time that I should talk about the things that I really enjoy. Buy them if you want. I don't know. I have these really great pens. I'm really enjoying them. They never stutter and they never run out of ink. Okay. So
essentially, these ads are your favorite things.
Yeah. You know what? Okay.
Oprah did it.
Okay, you two, look under your chairs.
She's great.
So excited to see your damn pen.
Right. Jason, take us home.
Well, I'm bringing up a topic that we have not talked about before, and something I've wondered about for a long time. Wait, what?
Nothing. Go ahead.
Which is prostitution or sex work, depending on how you want to describe
it. I love sex work. Okay, all right. I heard it the moment I said it. I'll contextualize that after your intro. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to try to keep this super brief, which, you know, is challenging for me.
Yeah, the three of us.
The short question is, should sex work be legal? And I will just frame it this way. I have struggled with this my entire adult life. I will say I've never procured the services of a prostitute, but because the libertarian side of me, like the left-wing libertarian in me, says if two consenting adults want to have a transaction that involves their bodies, why should anyone be able to stop them? And then I recognize that there's a lot of exploitation that happens where the extent to which the transaction is consensual for the woman is questionable when there's a man, a pimp, exploiting the woman, getting most of the money, maybe forcing her to do it. And then the last piece is we also know that prostitution, and this is to me the most gruesome part, there's a lot of prostituting of children. And so, you know, there's an article that just came out in the New York Times, Emily Bazelon.
Emily Bazelon.
Yeah, and so she wrote about there are two kind of sides of this right now. There are human rights and feminist groups who are advocating for decriminalization, and then there are those who are totally against it. And to me, it just leaves us with the question, and this is the question I pose to you. If we were to decriminalize or legalize sex work among consenting adults, is that likely to decrease the amount of exploitation of women and children or increase it?
I think your question is too complicated, so I'm going to talk about these really cute kittens I saw earlier. One was like snuggling up with the other one, and I was like, oh my god. No, to answer your question though, Jason, people have been throwing this question around for a very long time. And I think the correct answer is that it would neither increase nor decrease. It would change the landscape because we'd be changing culture. And now before earlier when I exclaimed, I love sex work, I love the idea that people, let's put exploitation just right to the side, right? In view, but just right to the side for a moment. I love the idea that people can use what is available to them and inject themselves into the economic landscape. I love the idea that people, when they have the choice, can make the choice to do so and not have the fear. Right after we tape this podcast, I'm about to go get a haircut. I'm going to pay someone to do something to me, and that is to my body, and that is my choice, right? I can go and get a massage and have someone, I can lie naked and have someone touch me everywhere. But the idea that the moment that becomes sexual, it's somehow illegal seems, it doesn't really click for me. And I think that's because it rests on a lot of Judeo-Christian ideas that I just don't subscribe to about our bodies and about virginity and about chastity. That has no functional or practical place. Now let's take exploitation off the shelf and put it back in the conversation. So like I said, I think it would certainly increase or decrease. I think when you think about it that way, a lot gets lost because it's a very complicated issue. The number one traffic thing on Earth, the number one most illegally trafficked substance on Earth is human beings. I think it would change the way that we think about exploitation. I don't know what it would do globally. I can only speak nationally because like the sex trade that happens overseas, it's so evil, like the concept, I can't really wrap my mind around how it works in the economic space because it seems like such a fantastically evil thing. And maybe that's my own limitation. But my point being is that I think sex work should totally be legal, and I think we should find a way to combat exploitation. And while those two things are linked, I don't know if they're as directly linked as people would like to make it. Trish?
Hmm. Now, this is interesting because in my other life, I'm on a board of an organization that gives funding to small women's projects. And we were at a board meeting recently, and one of our guest speakers was a grantee, and she was an ex-prostitute, and now she spends her time rescuing prostitutes from the street. And one of the things that she said, which was really startling, was that Chicago
I think, is the number one trafficker of women and girls in the United States.
Chicago? Oh, in the United States. Okay.
In the United States.
I thought you were going to say in the world. I was like, what?
No. But one of the things that you have to understand, though, Chris, is that it's not an international problem. It's a very much a big problem here in the U.S.
Which part of it is the problem?
The problem is trafficking, sex trafficking of girls.
Here?
Yes, it's big. It's not international. It's actually really big.
Really?
Yes, it's huge in the United States. It's one of those top thing that we don't talk about. But one of the points that she makes, though, about it, which is really interesting around sort of the exploitation angle, is that first and foremost, that if you get arrested, that stays on your record, even though you're actually a victim. So I think I'm actually for legalization after a certain age. So obviously it's between consenting adults. So if you can make it legal, then one of the things that I think immediately becomes possible is better policing of the exploitation.
Right.
Is that you can make, because one of the things that she says is, why does the prostitute get arrested but not the John?
Yeah.
Getting cops to participate in thinking about prostitution differently is a huge challenge for her. So it's like, this guy, most cops are sort of like, hey, why should this guy get arrested for wanting to get off? Because that's what it is. It's wanting to get off.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a crime. You know, they don't conceive of it as a crime in the way that we want them to. So therefore, now lots of young girls get exploited, and then they get arrested, and that creates a whole layer of things that they can't, even if they get clean and take care of themselves and all those kinds of stuff, they can no longer participate in certain things because they have an arrest record. In the United States, because we're a land of laws, when you bring something within that space, suddenly you can tackle it better. Suddenly there are resources. If you legalizing marijuana, suddenly there are things that you can be made more explicit.
Regulated.
I think if we can start to have, I think regulation is sort of what Americans do, right? That's our
reputation.
Tell
the Koch brothers. Don't tell the Koch brothers.
I know. We evaluate systems by how well they are regulated, right? And so by leaving it in this no man's land right now, it's just too dark. You need to bring more things to light. And then we can actually have explicit conversations about sex. We can have explicit conversations about who should not be having sex with prostitutes.
Well, these conversations are not conversations we want to engage in. We don't want to talk about sex at all here. So it's really difficult to talk about the value of prostitution when we don't even agree on the value of recreational sex.
But see, what I'm saying is once you put it in, I mean, this is sort of the weird thing, right? It's a catch-22, right? Because one of the things I remember years ago, someone saying, do you really want to introduce women's bodies as a space for the law to interact?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because once you go down that road, suddenly you're going to police all aspects of women's bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And we see the repercussions of that around abortion and all of those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, abortion should just have been a private thing, right? But no, it's not. It's now very much public. I think sex between two consenting adults is a space where we can easily enter the prostitution conversation. There are plenty of sort of legal work where people get exploited as well without any of the weird value judgment.
Hello, pro sports.
So,
oh, Lord.
Yes, you know what I mean? Those are that was exactly what I thought about. I thought about it with the student issues and I thought all about that. So, and you know, and I think it's a viable. I think it's a viable career. I think the reason why we have really weird ideas around it is because sometimes we really do know that people are doing it because they're forced to do it. Some people are doing it because they're addicted to drugs and they that make glee. You know, that conversation, because I think something real could come out of it.
You know, I'm reminded of something that happened here last year. There was a website called RentBoy.com. Mm-hmm. RentBoy.com, I know we're talking a lot about women, but I'm just circling back to prostitution and like the sex work. So RentBoy.com was a website where you can go to and you can put all the specifications of the man that you wanted to sleep with, and they would give you a bunch of escorts who you can then arrange a meet with. Although the site wasn't explicitly like, you know, you can put your body parts in their body parts and vice versa, it was pretty much understood. I mean, on a site where you can explicitly decide how big a penis you want and whether you want him to be cut or uncut, I think it's pretty much clear what's about to happen. And the site was going on for years, and I know people who advertise on the site and escort on the site and make quite a bit of money doing it. Anyway, the federal government closed it down last year, saying that it was prostitution, seized all their computers and files, and put a lot of people out of business. Now, I believe a lot of the men on rentboy.com were not being exploited. They had a business that they were running, and their business happened to be their own bodies, their own bodies. There were a lot of pieces written and linked to on Facebook just about who the victims of this really were. Now, in this one specific instance, because I'm not talking about exploitation here, in this one instance, we had a lot of independent contractors making money, doing their thing, fully understanding the ramifications of it, and taking care of themselves. They no longer have that outlet. And a lot of these people now are going to be forced, it's not a lot, but some of them are going to be forced to go back to prostitution the way it used to be, which was that they had to rely on someone else to provide the kinds of protections and whatever that the site and the structure allowed them to have. Yeah. And I think it's crazy the way that we view and deal with prostitution in this country. We are actually making it less safe when we make it less available, just like with drugs. And just like drugs, just like abortion, just like everything else that the right wing wants to take away, what we need to not do is shut this down for fear of exploitation. Like Trisha said, we can exploit people across the board. Sexual exploitation isn't the only game in town.
Right. Well, it sounds to me like this is an area we all agree with. The only thing I would say to respond to what you just said, Chris, which I want to make sure stays in the conversation, is this is not just – this is what I found so fascinating about the article. This is not just a right versus left issue. There is a big disagreement on the left.
Yeah.
I mean, I was interested. I didn't know how you two felt about this. We've never talked about it. Sounds like we all agree about it.
I love sex work. I think it's great. I really do. I honestly do. I've worked with a lot of young people over the years. This is how they made money. And they were not being exploited. They understood. And, you know, being a social worker, a lot of the services that I was providing was around this. But, like, these were young people who knew what they were getting into and understood where they were in the economic marketplace. I'm not saying they were completely healthy, but I'm saying these choices were their own. To take it away just for some weird ideas that we have about sex seems stupid. It's just stupid.
Well, and also, I mean, I don't know, Chris, I think we watched that Puerto Rican documentary about trans people in Puerto Rico.
Okay. I don't know.
I can't remember the name right now. It'll come to me. But one of the things that's really interesting about that documentary was the nature of sex work being explored there. And that in so many ways, because of our own prejudices as a society, sex work became the only option for a lot of those people. And because in some ways they didn't feel like they could dress the part and go into a 9-to-5, right? And then sex work became some sort of an option. And for me, one of the things that I started to think about was, well, what if we made sex work legal so that this is a viable option for the people who did this? And I really thought about it particularly around trans people, because I recognize our own societal biases. And so I don't know. I mean, my mind isn't entirely made up, but then again, I'm not hyper religious. So I don't have a kind of moral judgment about this that I really believe a lot of people have, which is where the resistance may come in. Which is like your body's a temple and you're God's children. And there are also these conversations about do you have poor self-esteem if you're doing it? I don't really know, because I mean, maybe you have poor self-esteem if you're sitting in an office all day listening to phone calls. You might not really. I mean, you know, I don't know. I can't. You know, I don't want to go down that road. But not everybody's fulfilled. You know what I mean? Not everyone is fulfilled.
Maybe you're not. I'm fulfilled. Damn it.
Not everyone is fulfilled in what they do.
At a fulfilled, yeah, right here, fulfilled.
And maybe you can be filled. I don't know, in prostitution. But I mean, I think sometimes as a country we can have, or as a country in a legal system, we can have conversations about these things without the kind of overarching moral judgments that are really best left to individuals.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Consensus.
No, weirdly, Christopher.
I do want to, this is not a sponsor, but I just want to give a shout out to this the sex workers project here in New York City.
Here. The others paid, but you're just giving a shout out.
This is just a shout out. The sex workers project in New York City. I worked in the same office with them years ago when I worked at a place called the Urban Justice Center. You should Google them. They do a lot of great work working with sex workers, making sure that they're protected, clearing their arrest records, et cetera, et cetera. Really look into it. Great stuff that they do. Big fans. So maybe I should have made that my recommendation. Damn it.
Oh, I know.
I've spoiled it. So now we're at recommendations.
You can say, and that was my recommendation. How about you two?
I could have.
Anyway,
I could have done that. So now we are all going to talk about a media event, something that we saw, heard, experienced that we think other people should see. Your experience, or if you're like Jason, just say whatever you want for like 3 minutes straight. Okay, so who wants to go first?
Well, I'll go first on that note.
Sure, just do whatever you want, Jason. Yeah. You completely ignore the segments.
I have some thoughts I'd like to share with the general public.
Just like a dream journal from the past.
So I mentioned earlier that I get my news from NPR. Yesterday I listened to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which I don't normally listen to, but I happened to catch it while I was in the car. And P.G. O'Rourke, who's, you know, a conservative commentator, funny writer, you know, is on this show. It's a very liberal show. And, you know, he made a lot of comments about his whole life is objecting to, you know, trying to offend NPR listeners. But he said he's voting for Hillary Clinton, and he gave these reasons why. And I thought it was great. I mean, it's just an example of – I mean, I disagree with him on a lot of stuff, but he is a thinking – you know, conservative, and he is so disgusted. I saw him a couple months ago on Bill Maher where he was talking about both Cruz and Trump. It was just saying, you know, I mean, he says it in a funny way, but just deploring just the awful choices in the Republican Party. And I just thought it was fascinating to hear him say publicly, out loud, I am voting for Hillary Clinton, saying it at this stage in the campaign. I thought that was pretty cool.
All right. I'm going to go next. I think you might already see this recommendation coming, but like I said earlier, I saw Captain America 3, Civil War, and I endorsed this movie so hard.
Why?
It was so good. The visuals, first of all, were stunning. Second of all, I love the story. I love that I don't know how many movies Marvel has made, but they've unfolded a story over many years and many hours, and I just think it really paid off. Now, you might have heard Trisha and I be critical earlier about the movie. Even with our critiques, I don't think it reduces the movie's entertainment value. Not at all. It was fantastic. I want to give a special shout out to Chadwick Boseman, who plays the Black Panther. Oh my God!
So
first
good.
Of all,
so good.
He's so hot. Second of all, so hot.
Oh my God! Believe you. Could you just calm down?
Let me tell you, Jason. Jason, you're not gay now, but when you watch this movie, you might turn gay.
I can't wait to watch it then. I'm going right out to see it now.
I know everyone's like Chris Evans, his muscles, his blonde hair, but let me tell you,
whatever.
Chadwick Boseman is so intense. Oh, all I could think about is all that intensity.
Oh my God. Okay. Trisha Stern, okay. I'm about to override your ass.
Although I will say Jason will leave the theater with a massive, massive crush.
Oh, I know on who.
Chadwick Boseman's bodyguard. Look for her. Look for her.
Second cameo, 6 seconds, and she says like one or two lines, and Jason, it will be the stuff of your dreams. She is gorgeous.
Okay, wait, can
are
I just say
who it is, or you're not
okay wait
it is.
Wait, can I just say what happened, Chris?
Yes, go ahead.
She walks out on, first of all, she walks out and her body is slamming.
You know what I'm saying? I'm a gay man, and in the theater, it wasn't a lot of people. I said, oh my God, out loud, she's gorgeous.
She walks out in these high heels, bald head, statuesque black girl, and her I mean, I hate to say it, I'm totally sexualizing her right now, but slamming body, slamming. Oh, and she's from the side. You see her from the side, so you know what I mean. She walks out, she's classic. Like an
upside down question mark.
Classic African-American body, classic. And then she delivers one line.
Yeah, because Black Widow is up in her face, and she just says, take it away, Trisha.
She says, move. Or be moved. And I was like, bitch, move me. Move me. Move me. I mean,
I would
fabulous.
Get right the fuck out of her way.
Yes. And, and Chadwick Boseman's response is perfect. He's like, this could be entertaining. But anyway.
He's like, anyway, I'd love to watch
this. And it would be. Anyway, it was great. Of course, I'm echoing Chris's thing, but I'm not going to do it. But I never go to see these things. I only went because the black quotient was high. Sorry. That's how I look at my movies now.
Three black men had key roles in this film. And key roles in this film. Pay attention, DC Comics. But yeah, Falcon, War Machine, and Black Panther, and none of them were sidebar roles. They were all...
No.
Oh, Falcon is black?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fully integrated into the story, which was really great. Great movie.
And none of them were the traditional, you know... I'm saving myself for no Bagger Vance.
I feel like you two bring up, no one in the world has even seen the damn movie except the three of us. And you two bring it up every episode.
And you know what? We'll expressly discuss our problems with Bagger Vance.
I've heard.
In another one.
I think everyone needs to know.
You reference it as if it's like a major cultural iconic movie. No one's seen the damn movie.
But you know what I want to say? Black people listening, you know exactly
what I'm talking
about. You know. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Let's just say Black Panther had agency.
And anyway. Intensity. Oh, and all arms. Right. Oh my God. He also had arms.
Okay,
can I just tell the listeners that Chris is literally at least half naked. I'm not sure whether whole, but at least half naked.
Rolling around in his bed.
That's how I'm recording it, rolling around in my bed thinking about Black Panther. Okay, anyway, Trisha, your recommendation, let's move on.
Completely as unsexy. So I'm gonna recommend and anti-recommend at the same time. So I've been listening to this wonderful podcast by it's called Edge of Sports with Dave Zirin. And he had two podcasts, and I was so looking forward to both of them. And one was fantastic, and the other was not.
Oops.
The first one was Michael Sam, the first gay man in the NFL. That was egregiously boring and sad because he had no conception of his own value in this moment, and that's sad. He was completely inarticulate about his role. LGBT athletes, and really what happened at Mizzou, you know, it was boring. He just wasn't good. However, the Glenn Greenwald, the Rio Olympics podcast was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was really, really wonderful because what was really interesting about it, it's a quick insight into what's going on in Rio right now politically. Why are they trying to get rid of the democratically elected politician president? Mm-hmm. Yes, that's really, really fascinating. But then it also gives us a little bit of insight into the United States' relationship with Brazil and the current tensions there. And it's a very brief interview, but I think it's a nice introduction. So I wholly recommend it. And also, Glenn Greenwald, I guess, runs a website called The Intercept, which is this really fantastic attempt to tackle news. I thought this was really interesting what he said. I wanted to be able to tackle news in a valuable way without having to be restrained by cost. 'Cause he's like,
I love that.
You know what I mean? Like, he's like, I want to do good work, but I don't want people to have to be poor to do it. So I'm always about that. If you could do great work, but without convincing your workers that they have to get paid nothing to do it.
Hello, I'm a social worker. I get that.
Yeah. So I highly recommend that podcast. I recommend the whole podcast in general, but I also specifically recommend that one. And then if you want to listen to the Michael Sam one and talk about why it was so bad.
I can't even. That's just very disappointing.
He's just not an articulate spokesperson. He doesn't understand his place in the landscape.
Oh, well. Well, I mean, all right. Well, there it is. Oh. All right, you guys. Well, this has been great. Enjoy the rest of your day. And listeners, you're going to hear from us again in 2 weeks.
Woo-hoo! So
manage your expectations and curb your enthusiasm. All right, everyone. See you later.
Bye, y'all.